Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, you sound a little serious today.
Well, I think the country as a whole has got to look at this as a very somber week. Mostly bad news. Terrible jobs report. 7.6% unemployment rate, highest since the early 1980s. Pancreatic cancer for one of the members of the Supreme Court, one nominee for a high cabinet post after another going down because of tax problems. The Congress can't pass a stimulus package. Well, at least had an enormous amount of difficulty doing it. It took everything they could possibly do to try to get it done. It's been a serious week.
You haven't mentioned the Yankees haven't won the World Series since 2000.
No, I'm talking about bad news. I'm talking about things that are bad for the country. And many have happened in this week. Just the second full week that Barack Obama's been president.
But I will not make the case, and you shouldn't make the case either, that Tom Daschle's withdrawal as HHS secretary is bad for the country.
But the fall of Nancy Killefer, that was a killer. Not to mention the tax problems of the husband of Hilda Solis.
It's bad news for the Obama administration.
Understood. But what I'm talking about is bigger bad things, such as the sense that it's just not possible for the government to respond in any kind of really effective way. Even if they do eventually get this economic stimulus package through both House, Senate, and a conference committee and signed by Barack Obama, I think we've all lost a great deal of faith that it's going to make a great deal of difference.
How important is it, since we don't have a stimulus vote in the Senate yet, how important is it for a lot of Republicans, I don't know what a lot means, but a lot of Republicans to come on board?
I don't think that it's absolutely crucial.
I don't think it is either. I agree.
I think it's window dressing to a certain degree. It's important to the Obama administration. They have gone the extra mile in some respects to try to get 10 or 15, ideally 20 Republicans to come over in the Senate.
Are there that many Republicans left in the Senate?
That would be about half of the Republicans in the Senate. But it would be mostly to be the contrast to what happened in the House, where they got zero Republican votes. And that creates a really brackish kind of atmosphere, much like we had in 1993 with the first Clinton budget that led to a lot of the contentiousness of those first 2 years and obviously cost the Democrats dearly politically.
Stop calling me dearly. But anyway, it seems like Harry Reid wants to give these so-called moderates the Ben Nelsons and the Susan Collinses of the world a chance to work out some kind of deal, cutting maybe $90 billion, $100 billion from the package. But ultimately, I think he's probably right. And he says, look, if we can't get that language, let's just have an up and down vote.
Yeah, and let's just pass it with Democratic votes, because after all, time is of the essence here. And if the thing falls apart in the Senate at this point, when it hasn't even gone back to a House Senate conference committee, and that's another hurdle we have to get over, I'm not sure they're going to get a bill. So they need to pass it.
Yeah. And I wonder if maybe perhaps if it passes without Republican support, maybe it's a win-win for both parties. Because if the Republicans are against it because of ideological reasons, they've stood their ground. But ultimately, I suspect that the country does need a stimulus package. Certainly, the Obama administration is arguing that it does. And so far, if it passes, then the Democrats get credit.
Okay, we should say they need a couple. I mean, they've got to have at least two or three Republicans or they're not going to have the 60 votes they need to hold off all considerations of budget rules and filibuster possibilities.
Right.
So they're going to need at least a couple, three Republicans to get this done. What they were hoping for would be a substantial chunk of Republicans to really make it look bipartisan. Now, we should say we're doing this on Friday, midday. We don't know yet exactly what the Republicans and Democrats in the Senate are going to be able to do, whether or not they'll be able to get this centrist compromise that 15, 16, 17 of them are trying to put together. But we assume that at some point the Senate will find a way to pass something that they can go to conference with the House on, and then we go through that.
We should explain, though, just because everybody expects their podcast on Thursday, the reason we didn't do it on Thursday because we thought there might be a late-night Senate meeting on Thursday night where they would pass it.
But let's talk a little bit about the Republicans, the situation that they're in. Just after we did last week's podcast, the Republicans did something they had never done before. They elected a chairman of the party, a national chairman of the party.
First former lieutenant governor of Maryland
ever to head
the Republican National
Committee.
Absolutely.
And it was earth-shaking. Yeah. I think a lot of people just kind of looked around and high-fived each other.
It was incredible.
Lieutenant governor of Maryland.
Former.
Also first African-American, which I'm also noticed.
Michael Steele, who elected, it's very interesting. Ron, I should let the listener know, Ron and I were corresponding during the RNC meeting. I did think Katen Dawson was the South Carolina Republican chairman was ultimately going to win the contest. But when it came down to the final ballot or the final ballots,
where we assumed Katen would take over the lead.
When Katen Dawson was down with Michael Steele, we were talking about what would it look like if a member of a restricted all-white country club until he resigned.
In South Carolina.
In South Carolina. Defeated the first serious African-American candidate for chairman of the RNC. And I think that's...
He'd been ahead on many ballots at that point.
That's right. And that's why we realized at the end that it would be Michael Steele for that reason. And Kenneth Blackwell, the other African-American candidate in the race, when he withdrew, he also endorsed Michael Steele. And that was interesting. I think that was the turning point at the RNC.
We weren't sure that was going to happen because they are fairly far apart on ideology. Michael Steele was probably the most moderate Republican of the five finalists.
Some say liberal, right.
Yeah, of the five finalists for the chairmanship. So that's another factor in here, too. So what is going on with this Republican Party? They now have a moderate to liberal, by Republican standards, chairman of the party, an African-American, changing the symbology of the party, at the same time as here in Congress, with the 177-0 vote in the House on the stimulus package and the great difficulty of bringing any Republicans over in the Senate, they seem to be taking a more ideologically hardline conservative position. What's the Republican Party reaction to Barack Obama overall? I put it to you, Ken.
I'm wondering what the Republican Party message is trying to be, because obviously with the election of Michael Steele, although I suspect, though, that it doesn't really matter who the chairman of the RNC is. It matters what the policies are, and what we've seen in the House and the Senate so far, at least on the stimulus package, is that they're trying to send a message that this is not the way the party should go, or the country should go even. Now, of course, there are more incentives, and apparently there have been a bunch of tax-cutting incentives and more incentives for businesses, things like that, is designed to get more Republicans. But I'm just wondering if they just want to be obstructionist. That's not the word I would use. But
yeah, that's a negative characterization.
No, right.
They're basically saying in Congress, they're saying we'll play the cards we have. Sure, we're reduced to historic lows in the House and Senate, but we don't think we're going any lower, and we think we come back by being true to our principles and bouncing back in 2010. And if that means making this fledgling new Democratic president fail or flail or look bad, him's doing it on his own.
See, that's a good
point.
They
can point to Daschle and these
Prancer
other...
and
they
Vixen.
Can point to all those problems.
Right. No, but actually, you're making a good point about their principles, because one of the biggest criticisms of Republican lawmakers made by Republican voters in 2006 and 2008 is that Republicans did not stick to their principles. They allowed the Bush spending... Lost their way. I mean, it sounds like an excuse, but it's true, though. It's not... If this were a Democratic president in 2001 to 2008 with all these spending programs, I think a lot of conservatives in the House and Senate would have been more outraged than they were.
I think that's right.
Two bits of news about we talk about Republican numbers in Congress. Two bits of news. First of all, Norm Coleman seems to have new life, at least possibly new life, in Minnesota. The panel of three judges agreed that Norm Coleman could bring evidence regarding 4,797 rejected absentee ballots.
But he wanted to bring evidence concerning far more.
11,000, right.
Yeah, more than twice as many.
But remember, Al Franken only has a lead of 225 votes right now, so 4,797 votes theoretically could change the picture in Minnesota.
Yes, if there's any reason to think that those votes are Norm Coleman votes in the predominant.
It does give him a lifeline, as some people have said.
It's still possible that he could pull this out.
But we will not have an answer until March at the earliest. The other news, Republican news, is what happened in New Hampshire. And some Republicans are wondering about this. Judd Gregg, three-term senator, who was clearly favored, even though New Hampshire is turning blue.
Blue.
Yes.
I mean, it's gone blue for president now twice in a row.
Right.
It's got another blue senator.
Right.
And Jean Shaheen just won.
Two Democratic members of the House.
And a Democratic governor.
Right. And a Democratic houses of legislature, both houses for the first time since the 1900s.
And so Judd Gregg was kind of wondering if maybe as the Lone Ranger Republican still holding out, he was a little bit vulnerable.
Well, but they say that's not why he left to become Commerce, because
no.
He wanted to follow in the footsteps of Herbert Hoover, who went from Commerce to presidency, and that worked so well.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, so Judd Gregg will leave the Senate when he's confirmed. And so the new senator is Bonnie Newman.
Hello, Newman.
So Bonnie Newman is a Rockefeller Republican. She was Judd Gregg's chief of staff when he was a member of the House.
Way back in the 80s.
Right. She worked for President Reagan, the first President Bush.
Back in the 80s.
But she was also, in 2004, she was the head of Republicans for Lynch, John Lynch, who was elected governor of New Hampshire against a Republican incumbent in 2004. So
the Democrat who now just appointed her.
And Judd Gregg said
States
he
Senate.
Would not leave the Senate unless he was replaced by a Republican. John Lynch went along with it. Now, what it does, of course, it opens up a seat that the Republicans were likely to win, I suspect, in 2010.
Yeah, Gregg would have been reelected.
And gives Democrats another shot at
because
an open
Newman
Republican
will
seat.
Not run.
No,
Bonnie
will
Newman
not run.
Will not run in 2010. And so now we're sort of assuming that we see one of the two House members.
Paul Holds is already
both,
announced.
They're both interested.
And we think that John Sununu, the former senator who was beaten by Shaheen in 2008, will run for that seat.
Interestingly, his father, John Sununu, the one who was the chief of staff to the first President
and
Bush
governor.
And former governor, has just been elected the new chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party.
Yeah, that was
how
interesting.
How odd. What a counter trend. There's, again, another case of the Republican Party in the face of a lot of adversity. And in that state, they've had just about all they can imagine. Turning back to people who hark back to a more successful era, but do not really seem to be future-oriented or change-oriented Republicans.
Now, if Judd Gregg was a surprising news for the Republicans, I assume that Tom Daschle was a surprising news for the Democrats.
I think Tom Daschle's fall was one of the most stunning things that I have seen in 25 years in Washington. He was one of the stars of the new Obama administration. He was the guy they were totally trusting to bring health care to fruition. I mean, health care reform and overhaul of the system to some sort of fruition this year in this Congress. And now I just don't see how it's possible. There is no one who can step into those shoes who has become apparent in the last 48 hours who could get it done in anything like that kind of period of time.
Chuck de Gaulle, you know, my friend Chuck, would always talk about the cemeteries are filled with indispensable men. But if there was anybody thought to be indispensable on health care, it was Tom Daschle. Now, the New York Times reported this week that last weekend, Tom Daschle said, look, I'm being a distraction. I think I should bow out. Obama said, no, keep fighting for this. Now, some people are wondering whether it's hubris on Obama's part that even though there was seemed to be a serious populist rebellion against Daschle because of taxes, because of the lobbying, because of the income he made, because of potential conflicts of interest, Obama said, no, keep fighting. You will be confirmed. I guess most Democrats felt he would be confirmed.
And I do still believe he would have been confirmed. Now, maybe the price would have been too high. Maybe the wreckage, maybe the change in people's opinion of Barack Obama would have been too high a price to pay. Interesting, though, that Obama himself was willing to take that risk. And it was not he who pushed Tom Daschle. It was Daschle who decided he'd had enough.
But you know something, what may have been a turning point was the withdrawal of Nancy Killefer from the administration job, because a lot of people felt that she had, I think she had a $298.
The final tax lien was $900.
With $950 on her house, and it was a $298 that she failed to pay for her.
I mean, that's like parking tickets.
But she's a woman, and here she is pulling out while Barack Obama.
But we don't really know why she pulled out. It did not ever seem to make sense that she would give up if she really wanted this job of being the, you know, efficiency czar for the whole federal government, kind of a tough task, kind of a hard thing to imagine anybody accomplishing. But if she wanted it in the first place, if she wanted to try her hand at making the federal government work better and be efficient, I think it would be worth taking a little bit of guff for a $900 tax lien that she had paid.
But Geithner was taking guff and Daschle was taking guff, and maybe...
You know, and Geithner got confirmed, and he got confirmed
could
without...
You imagine- Could imagine if he had not been confirmed votes. Yet? Could imagine if he was up now?
If he were up now, I suppose that the heat would be hotter.
My argument, though, is that with her withdrawal, it seemed kind of weird for Obama to defend Daschle when a woman left.
I do understand, although I think the gender angle might have been a little bit overplayed. I do think that by pulling out, she added a certain amount of inevitability to Daschle's doing the same.
Do you have predictions for HHS Secretary?
You know, I think the best move they could make now, even though it would look like some kind of scrambling and temporizing, and so certainly it would be.
A deal.
I think the best thing they could do now would be to say, you know what, we liked Leon Panetta at CIA, but this job is more appropriate for his background, and it's a bigger job, and now we need Leon in this job.
Wait, you would give up his intelligence credentials?
Yeah. Now, Leon Panetta doesn't need to be at CIA. That's not his natural fit. He's apparently going to be easily confirmed. His hearings were a complete love fest. There was no problem at all. So he's going to be confirmed at CIA, but is that the best? Is that the highest use of Leon Panetta right now? I think he's got the closest thing to the Tom Daschle skill set we're going to find.
He doesn't have, of course, the experience on health issues. But
in the
he does.
Senate. He hasn't been in the Senate, but he's certainly seen it all in that.
And
House.
He does have the strong support of Obama, which, of course, Daschle did. And there are a lot of Daschle people working very closely with Obama. It's, I mean, again, we're talking about indispensable men, and he did make a mistake, and he apologized for the mistake, and it was probably the right decision, I think, to withdraw given the populist outrage over Daschle, and yet the Obama people lose a giant, I think, in that whole situation.
A special person, if not indispensable, at least quite special. So in the midst of all of this, then we also get the very sobering news about Justice Ginsburg and pancreatic cancer, apparently caught very early, apparently a successful surgery, but still a pretty tough diagnosis to get. She is in her 70s. She may choose to retire, although she certainly has not made any kind of indication.
She says she wants to go back to work, expects to go back to work.
As fast as possible, 3 weeks. She's never missed a day.
If you listen to Nina Totenberg's reports, though, a lot of people feel that may not be likely.
It may not be possible.
Yeah.
And certainly her will is there. It's just the possibility of the disease being too far advanced. So if it is necessary for the president to choose someone for that seat on the court, without getting into a lot of names, I mean, just because she is the only woman on the court presently, I think we can assume that the appointee would be a woman. It also underlines the fact that in this first presidential year or two, certainly in a first term, Barack Obama might very well be naming as many as two or three or even more Supreme Court justices. Extraordinary considering that some presidents haven't gotten to appoint any.
But if you look at the justices who are either ill or thought to be close to retiring, and it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and it's John Paul Stevens, and it's
David Souter.
And it's David Souter, they're all liberals. So in other words, even though Barack Obama will have an opportunity to put his imprint on the court, it may not change the ideological balance.
It might be primarily a matter of installing younger people right. in the liberal slots and playing defense.
Ron, by the way, some sad news, of course, but some good news to report. We did get an email from the listener.
The listener?
Yes. Now,
except this is the second time the listener
It's from Taylor Kay. Taylor Kay writes, I love the podcast. I only wish it was longer so there would be time for more bad puns. You and Ron are a fantastic team.
Now, that's it for this week's
Taylor movie. Kay of South Portland, Maine, and I remember the Maine. That was an 1898 joke.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
Do we also want to mention, though, that Arthur Davis this week announces his candidacy, congressman from Alabama, African-American, running for governor, the first serious African-American
candidate for governor of Alabama. So, the home of George Wallace.
Right.
Is Arthur Davis going to be elected governor of Alabama, or is he just perhaps a bridge too far for interracial politics
Good
in America?
Good question, but we did see the capital of the Confederacy elect an African-American governor in 1889.
And that is Virginia, of course.
Doug Wilder. So it'd be interesting, the election of Barack Obama, what it does to increase African-American candidates for office, Senate, governor, Congress in 2010.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.